Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and that's Thank You, Mr. Mandela by Carlin Davis. On this day in 1996, Nelson Mandela signed the new South African Constitution into law. On this day in 1993, both Nelson Mandela and President de Klerk received the Nobel Peace Prize. I guess they had to give it to de Klerk, but Mandela did deserve it. So good to have you all with me here on the Mark Steiner Show. That's my editorial comment for that moment. And reminding you on the way this conversation, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you. Money comes back in the end. More information at www.mecu.com or at steinershow.org, MeQ, Baltimore Credit Union's banner. All the information is right there. And we are going back to one of our monthly episodes here, which is If I Were Mayor. And we want to combine this with a conversation we wanted to have and we'll be having over the coming weeks with numerous young people at different universities in our community who were leaders in part of the demonstrations that took place in Baltimore around Ferguson and Staten Island and Eric Garner's death and more. And these are the young people who are the leaders of those things from three different universities we have here. We are joined by Scheherazade Abdelmajid, who is a second-year law student at the University of Baltimore School of Law and president of the American Constitution Society for Law and Policy. And Scheherazade, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Hello.
Brian Upshur's here. He's parliamentarian for the Black Law Student Association, a second-year law student, representative for the University of Baltimore Students for Public Interest, and gets his law degree in 2016. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
Brian, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, sir.
Mayor Kayla Brown is a student here at Morgan State University and is a board member of the Baltimore Algebra Project, and someone I already know. Good to have you back in the studio, Michaela.
Thank you for having me.
And Joseph Kent's with us, who joined us last week by phone as he was about to lead new demonstrations of students here at Morgan State University. And he's a leader and organizer here in Baltimore and a junior here at Morgan State University. And welcome. Good to have you on the program.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome back. Brianna Arrington is with us.
Thank you for having me.
There you're down there. Okay, hi. Brianna Arrington is president of the Black Student Union and Women's Programming at the Maryland Institute College of Art. Micah, good to have you here in the studio.
Thank you.
And Nikki Hendricks is vice president of the Black Student Union at the Maryland Institute College of Art. Micah, Nikki, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
All right. Full house. 410-319-8888 is the number here. You can log on to our Facebook pages. You can tweet me at Mark Steiner. Write to us at talk@steinershow.org or just join us at 410-319-8888. And as the conversation begins to unfold, what would you do if you were mayor of Baltimore? We want to hear your thoughts and let our respondents talk about that as well. 410-319-8888. But let me begin just by talking a bit about these demonstrations that took place. They were almost independent and spontaneous on these different campuses. It just erupted. Am I right about that? I mean,
yes, sir.
Brian, you didn't like consult with Morgan or Micah. This is something that just happened where you are.
Yeah, no, it was very beautiful because everything that happened, everyone did pretty much on their own. At UB, just the way it kind of came together was that students were upset. They sat down. They said, we don't like this, and we don't like what would happen. We want to say something. We want to make a statement. And literally the next morning, we get up, and after posting on social media, I guess the newspaper picked it up, which was awesome. And then we did it. We had so much support from the school. We had support from people in the community. We had support from even students at MICA that came in and stood out in front of the law school and actually made a statement through the demonstrations that we had. So it was a very beautiful thing. It was great.
And how did that work, Brianna, at MICA?
Well, it was a lot of word of the mouth. We're a small institution, predominantly white institution, and we are, I would like to say, a bubble, and we are as connected to the other institutions in Baltimore as we would like to be. But some of my fellow students, they were hearing it, and they have other friends at these schools, and they said, we should go do this. We need to do something. And they told me, we spread the word, and we showed up, and we showed out.
Michaela, how about here at Morgan State?
Actually, I didn't organize with Morgan. I organized with Be More Black, and then Morgan joined us while we were at City Hall. But it was the same thing. It was like word of mouth. People were outraged, and we decided it was time to do something about it. And because Morgan had protested all day long, we decided that we should connect with Morgan later that evening when we protested downtown.
So how did it start here, Morgan? What was the...
Actually,
we actually heard about all the tragedies that was happening and the police brutality. And we started a protest at Morgan around the community of Morgan around the campus. And then we took the streets, the community around the streets of Baltimore. And then we actually found out that it was a big protest going on downtown City Hall. So we actually had enough people, like it already made CNN and the media of our Morgan students already. So we actually was putting together, it wasn't even planned for us to march down to City Hall. Like, we actually had a conversation about everybody getting transportation to get down there. And then more people came out to show. You had people in the community around Morgan State coming out to protest with us and join the crowd and everything. Before you know it, it was like a couple hundred of us. So we actually marched down to City Hall. We met up with different groups, different colleges on our way. Different people was joining the crowd. And at the end, we actually, it was positive, with no violence. And I actually met up with a different kind of organizations, as far as like Baltimore Block and everything like that. And I've been like connecting with them, and that's about it.
This is the beginning. Shahrazad.
To piggyback on what Brian said, I feel like also for us as law students, just by nature of where we were, I thought we realized that us being in a position where we are going to be future lawyers, we are going to be in a position where we can help shape policy one day. So for us, it was just so much more important for us to get out there, and we felt like we needed to do something because we can help change this one day. So I think for us, when we all sat and talked about it, that was like one thing that we all sat and said, you know, like, we can do something about this one day, so we need to make our voices heard now. We're learning the law, so we need to go out there and do what we can.
And you had a die-in, right?
Yes.
And more than that, but it was one of the things you all did there.
Right, and we did it directly in front of the law school. Mm-hmm. And as our dean said, I don't think that we could have picked a better place.
Right. And Brianna, over here, I'm sorry, Nikki, we haven't heard from you yet. So I'm curious, and let me move this so I can actually see people. There we go, that's better. And for you, the significance of this, one of the things I've noticed about these demonstrations that have taken place here and across the country was, A, how many of the women were at the forefront of these demonstrations, different than I've seen in years past, when everything was male-dominated. And also the deeply interracial nature of these demonstrations are taking place.
I noticed, especially at MICAH. MICAH is predominantly white, so the majority of our supporters were white or diverse, and it wasn't just black students. So it was when we marched from MICAH to the square, Mount Vernon Square. It was, we had women, we had men of all races, all backgrounds, and it was a really beautiful thing. I think people are starting to realize this is not just a black issue. This is an issue that affects everybody. So it was really wonderful to see that. And me as a woman being in these protests, like, I see my brother, I see my dad, I see, you know, a future husband, things like that, you know. Like, I just, it's important for us to be a part of the fight in solidarity and support.
What do you all think is for you is kind of the significance of this moment? I mean, these things happen in American history. What I said a few weeks ago on this program, as we started talking about after the Darren Wilson verdict came in, and then of course the Eric Garner's the lack of indictment of the officer who killed him that came in, and everything else been going on around America, that we seem to be at a place where something very explosive is happening in this country. And there's a lot of pushback. Racist pushback, I think, in this country. You experienced that at Mike when somebody wrote the N-word or something in the elevator.
They wrote kill black people.
Kill black people. Yes. Kill black people. And you had this giant town meeting at the end of the night, right? Mm-hmm. At 10:30, was it?
It was 10:30 at night. By that time, everyone should have been out of class. And over 300 students showed up in this tight space. And they voiced their concerns. And they addressed campus safety, asking questions about how this was, how the investigation was going. And other students of all races were just showing their concerns and their love. And it was just a really beautiful thing to feel like people really do value your life.
So what do you all think is the significance of this moment historically, which you're sitting in? Do you ever ponder that? what you're doing and where it fits into what's happening in this world?
I think that it's important to recognize that though people came before us and they were doing wonderful things and they achieved many things, we still have a long way to go.
Yeah.
You know, when you're looking at the documents that created this country, they talk about a more perfect union. They recognize that then and now and before, the union is never actually perfect, but we have to continue to strive to make it better, to constantly improve it. I think that right now, when you're talking about so many people being killed by the police officers, and it being so well put out by the media, and people recognizing it, it makes it a tipping point. I think that when you talk about over 200 people being arrested in New York City in one night, when you talk about people not even in cities recognizing how dangerous it is and how important it is for us to make change. I think that this is a moment that will in 50 years resemble that of the civil rights movement. I think that is what we're looking at right now. That's my personal opinion.
And go ahead. Anybody else want to jump in on that? We'd love to hear your thoughts on what you think, where we are. Go ahead, Sherazade, and then we'll come over here.
I think it's significant because we read about what happened in the civil rights movement, but I think that right now what's happening, something's going on and people are making statements, and I think it's great that we get to be a part of it, and then this is something that generations to come will read about, and we can say that we were a part of it. We were the next generation of Thurgood Marshalls. So I think that's awesome.
Yeah. That's interesting. It's spoken from by a law student. I like that. Joseph, Ken, what were you going to say?
Yeah, I actually was going to piggyback off of what she said. I feel as though that this is important, being as though we are a younger generation that we coming up and we already getting our career and we college students and everything like that. I feel like it's important to like send a positive message because it's a lot and it's being consistent. And if we sit back and be like compliant with this and ignore the fact that this keep happening around the world, just not in Baltimore, and it's not just a black issue like she said, it's Rihanna. Not just a black issue. It's
Nikki. I'm sorry. Rihanna's not sorry. Nikki, go ahead.
It's about what's right and what's wrong at the end of the day. And I feel like when we look back on this later down the line, we can actually say, oh, we was a part of the change. We was a part of the solution.
So what do we think is, from your perspectives here, what is the change, I mean, that has to be made? What is happening here now, do you think, from your own analysis, living the life you've lived? You know, we're seeing every day there are more examples of police either brutalizing or killing African-Americans, people of color especially, but we just saw Brian Saylor, the young white man who had Down syndrome, who was killed by a police officer when he didn't leave the theater because he got confused, wanted to stay at the next theater, and they handcuffed him, and the same thing they did with Tyrone West, and he died. Mm-hmm. But nobody was indicted in that case either. So what is your idea about where we need to go to society? What has to change? How do we get there? Go ahead.
Nikki.
I don't want to get the mic and students mixed up. Nikki. Okay, good.
I think that there should be less of a gap between the police and mm-hmm. the community. I feel if the community if the police work more in the community, like doing programs, enrichment programs, working with people of the community, they would know these people before they killed them. They would have sympathy. They would have empathy. They would try to calm someone down if they were upset because they'd understand. They'd understand why they were acting the way they were. Or even then, they wouldn't try to hurt us in the first place if they saw...
Let's go over here to Brianna.
I think a change that needs to happen is...
That's right. No, go ahead.
We need to humanize people again. I think a main problem is, with black children specifically, they're dehumanized at a very young age. Like that young boy who was just 12 years old, he had a toy gun, and they was like, okay, he needs to go down. But there are plenty of young white children who have real guns that their parents give them at a young age, and they're not dehumanized for it. So I think that we need to like get to a point where everyone is seen as people. Everyone matters. And I don't know how that's going to happen. It's not going to happen overnight, but that is exactly what needs to happen.
Sherazade, what are you going to say? Then we'll go over here.
I think that one of the biggest things is reevaluating the policies that are in place and making sure that there's some sort of accountability for these sorts of things when they happen. So I think that's probably the biggest thing also, like one of the biggest things that we can do is reevaluate the policies and ensure that there's accountability. And then the people that are in power, those positions that are in, able to implement these policies, make sure that they're going to do that. So,
Michaela, then we'll come back over here to UB, to Brian.
I was going to say something similar. I was going to suggest that we need to reevaluate things like the Law Enforcement Bill of Rights. We need to take a look at those things and redesign them in a way that doesn't, that protects officers but also holds them accountable for the things that they do to civilians. Another suggestion I would have is a civilian review board and having it so that officers' peers aren't the ones who are reviewing their police brutality cases. Because at the end of the day, you're going to look out for your friend or your brother in blue. So there should be more civilians, more everyday citizens, more mothers, more teachers, more students, more law students who are actually sitting on these review boards, who are reviewing these cases and giving actual solutions that can be applied to whatever the case may be to make sure that this isn't happening again.
Brian, you're going to say what?
I think that transparency, accountability is the most important part to look at right now. When you talk about our police system, you talk about a system that was created with the idea that we need to have the community engage with the police officers. When you don't trust the police officers, that takes away the police officers' efficiency. It takes away their effectiveness in their job because they don't have the ability to prevent crime like they're supposed to when they don't have community engagement. One way that we can increase it, one way that we can rebuild our partnership is through the use of police body cameras. When we have the ability to review what's going on with police, we have the ability to increase trust with the police. That's the goal. That's the idea. We need to have an ability to say, okay, this is what the police did right, this is what the police did wrong, and this is what they need to fix, and this is how they can fix it. When you talk about someone in Baltimore City like Colin Truss, right, who didn't, there was no police body camera, however, it was recorded, and you see that a police officer, the report that the police officer gives is different than what we actually have on camera. That's a situation that we need to address. That is an opportunity that we have that we instill in the police the use of body cameras, and then we can then record it, review it, and teach them what they're doing wrong, but then also show the community all the instances where police are actually doing stuff right. Listen, I don't think that police are inherently evil. I mean, some of them are doing something wrong, but in the idea of the police to help citizens, to serve people, that's what many of them sign up for. That's what many of them want to do. And I think that by showing the bad apples and by showing the good apples, we have an opportunity to increase trust in our community.
I'm going to open the phones here, and folks who want to join this conversation, before we switch gears, and ask you what you would do if you actually had a chance to be mayor of Baltimore, how you would rethink what we do in this city. How many of this crew are from Baltimore originally? So 4 out of 6. Okay, just checking. 410-3, we'll come right back, Brian. 410-319-8888. Let's go to the phones, and Seth, you're on the air.
Hi, everyone. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Seth.
Thanks for picking my call. I appreciate you guys for taking the words right out of my mouth. Like, I feel like there's no connection between the police and the community on a positive and uplifting level. Everything's out of fear. Everything's out of enforcement. And I really feel like, you know, because when I was younger, I was a child, I was in the Boy Scouts, and it's just the littlest thing as the like the Christmas holiday, the fire department will be a part of the Boy Scouts, and they will, you know, let the children come inside the firehouse, explain, you know, how the procedure works, ride on a fire engine, and they roll Santa Claus around on the fire engine, you know, just things like that. It's just, I really don't see that. I would see the police extending their hand to the youth, extending their hand to the community on a positive level, unless it's having to do with enforcing some type of criminal justice or just spreading positivity. So I thank you guys for saying that, and I totally agree.
Thank you so much. Let's get a call in here, then we can come back to the comments around the table at 410-319-8888. Nick, you're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Hi, Nick.
Everyone. Thanks for taking my call. I have a comment to make for one of your guests. It was a lady that was speaking about how white kids are given guns by their parents, but black kids are not. They don't have guns. Something to that effect. I can't remember exactly every word she said.
Okay, all right.
Just like to know if you know the statistics for gun violence in Chicago and how it was caused. I'm only saying that because in 2012, there was over 400 kids in Chicago shot at by their peers, inner city Chicagoans. Now, I don't condone violence at all, but don't you think it should start with the parenting?
All right, let's go through this. This comes up a lot, and I think that Nikki.
Brianna.
I'm sorry. I'm going to have to figure out which one is. I'm going to hate this. Having just met you all, so thank you, Brianna. That we hear this a lot in the program. Let me get your thoughts on this. I mean, you know, we heard also Rudolph Giuliani on debating Michael Eric Dyson. I don't know if you heard that or not on, I forget which TV station it was, about this issue. And where he said 94% of all African Americans were killed by other African Americans. And then what Derek Dyson was saying in response was, yes, and 84% of all white Americans killed are murdered by other white Americans. And that we're talking, on the one hand, about the kind of violence that poverty perpetrates in America and creates in our world. But that's not the same thing as saying we need to hold the police accountable for their actions because they are servants of the state. And I think there was another comments were made we've debated on the show a lot, which has to do with saying that that people are not outraged in the black community when black kids are killed inside the community, which is just an absurdity because people are outraged all the time and always in there trying to change that situation and turn it around. So let me throw that out there first as a caveat. Go here and there, okay?
I mean, I think when we talk about these statistics, I mean, you can get statistics to say whatever you want. If you talk about the right person, you talk to the right person, you're going to get the answer that you want to hear. Mm-hmm. But when you talk about the 90% that or 94% whatever that was quoted on the news by the former mayor, you have to understand that's in New York. In the country, about 83-84% of black people are killed by black people. About 83-84% of white people are killed by white people,
right?
Because you have a tendency to kill the people you know. And we have a tendency to be around the people that we know. That's what happens. So you look at these numbers and you want these numbers to mean something, and really they don't. What it really means is that, well, we have cops killing people. I don't like seeing our government killing people, and we don't want that. So let's not point fingers and say, okay, well, here's another problem. No, let's solve the problem that we're talking about right now. And that's what we want to look at.
And Brianna, take us to break.
I just wanted to say that people have been saying this to me all the time throughout this whole all these protests and this fight against police brutality. But at the end of the day, of course, black people are killing black people. I know this. I've witnessed it all my life. But at the end of the day, as much as it hurts to see your own people killing each other, it hurts even more to look out to the rest of the world and have them fear you and look at you differently, and the people that's supposed to be protecting you are killing you too. And I understand these statistics that you're throwing at me, but at the end of the day, I don't need any more people added on to who's trying to kill me.
So we're going to take a very brief break. Dickens is our next caller up, who has a comment about what he would do if he was mayor. We're going to find out what these students in our room would do if they were mayor of this city, how they begin to change Baltimore and the communities around them. 410-319-8888. We'll be right back right after this break, and we are going to break with Mood Indigo, performed by Ella Fitzgerald, music by Duke Ellington. Duke Ellington first recorded this hit, Mood Indigo, on this day in 1930. We'll be right back.
Till you've had that mood indigo, that feeling goes stealing down.
Just like this river, I've been running ever since. It's been a coming, but I know change has got to come now. Ooh, yes it is.
That's a song that's appropriate for this discussion and all the ones we're having here in the Mark Steiner Show. The great Otis Redding, who died at 26 in the stand-up plane crash. You have to turn the music off. It's sounding too good, man. Why you turn it off? A Change Is Going to Come by the great Otis Redding. And a change is going to come, and part of that change is going to come with this young generation coming up who are taking leadership of what's happening in the struggles in America. We are joined here by Scheherazade Abdelmajid, who is a second-year law student at the University of Baltimore and president of the American Constitution Society for Law and Policy. Her colleague in class, Brian Upshur, is parliamentarian for the Black Students Association, a second-year law student at UB. Michaela Brown, a student here at Morgan State University, who's a board member of the Baltimore Algebra Project. Joseph Kent, a leader and organizer here from Morgan State University, and a junior here of the protests that came out of Morgan. Brianna Arrington, who is president of the Black Student Union and Women's Programming at the Maryland Institute College of Art. And Nikki Hendricks, who is vice president of the Black Student Union at MICA, 410-319-8888. You all look like you're about to jump through the mic here. Before we go to our callers to talk about what we do with Mayor Baltimore, you had this intense conversation going on in here about what the real issues were. You want to reprise that very quickly for us? Go right ahead, Scheherazade.
Sure. I just think that saying that black violence is, like, putting that at the forefront, I think you're shifting the burden to somewhere that it doesn't need to be. The issue is that as police officers, these individuals are state actors, and they're acting in a capacity where they are supposed to protect and serve, and they're just, you're not doing your job if you're killing people for no reason, or the state isn't doing its job if it's choosing not to charge these individuals. So I think that's the real issue, looking at what's happening with the system in general, as opposed to looking at individuals who are not in that same position to serve. So I don't think that's an issue, and I think it's kind of like a farce for what's really going on.
So a lot of people are good at calling in here, and unless you would have anything to say now, I'm going to ask you another question if I can, unless you have something. It's burning. You've got to get out of this moment.
Well, the only thing that really, really I think is important is the guy, the caller, he said, don't you think it starts at home? As of implying that these individuals who were slain by cops, it was like their fault or has something to do with their behavior. One man was choked to death by a police officer. Another man was shot to death by a police officer for walking in the middle of a street. Another man was shot in a stairwell for simply walking through a stairwell. I think that when you say it doesn't start at home, it kind of implies something that's not true. And it kind of implies that, you know, we're doing something that we're not supposed to be doing when really the people who are wrong are the people with the guns.
410-319-8888. It's never here. You can also write to us at talkinstandardshow.org. So on the way back to the phones, let me ask one of the reasons you all are here, besides to talk about this incredible work you're doing on our campuses to change our society and struggle to move us forward, was the question, as rising young leaders, if you were mayor of a city like Baltimore, what would you do that's being done that's differently than what you're seeing happening now? How would you transform a place like this? Go ahead.
Well, I will put in
Joseph Kent Morgan.
I will put in organizations and things for polices like that have like. Cause I was just talking to like one of my police friends yesterday. He 16 years in the police force.
Are you from Baltimore?
Yes. And we was actually talking about polices that come to work. They have anger problems and too high things with police officers. They lose their personal relationship with their family or their loved ones because of the job they do. And when they come to crime scenes and stuff like that, they are trained to come at the low and if need to be, bring it high to control the situation. Police officers tend to already come high, and I feel like they antagonize the situation. They make it worse than what it have to be. And I feel like a lot of police officers have, like, mental, psychotic-type problems that need to be evaluated. Like, you do one evaluation when you first become a police officer, but I feel like that should be a requirement, like, every year or twice a year for police officers that be out there and working on the streets. And I feel like if I was mayor, I put in place for, like, different classes and stuff that police will be required to take to see what's going on in their head, because I think that could be a problem why everything going on as far as police brutality to it.
I'm afraid if we look inside some people's heads, we might not want to be here anymore, but I think you're right. 410-319-8888, and we're going to come to Dickens and Melissa right here. But any other thoughts you want to jump in on? I was thinking about, go ahead.
I mean, What I would do immediately is I would instill police body cameras. I think that the success we've seen in other jurisdictions using body cameras, even jurisdictions in Maryland, suggests that we need to have it everywhere. In every jurisdiction in Maryland and every jurisdiction across the country. But because we live in Maryland, because we live in Baltimore City, that's what I'm concerned about right now. And I think that we've seen so much information. In one case, half of the police officers at any given time have a body camera on them. And this period that only 50% of the police officers have body cameras, we've seen a decrease in complaints of 88%. And that's just one case alone. I think that the body cameras are such an immediate action that we can do it right now. The president is behind it. The president says he wants money for it. The president says he wants to see body cameras on police officers as well. I think that this is a good idea, and this is something that we need to move forward with right now.
So let me ask a question that might be completely different than what we've been talking about. But it made me think of this because I know of Michaela's activism in the community, and I know that four of you are at institutions that are in this world that we're redeveloping all through the middle of the city, MICA and UB. Mm-hmm. And you're seeing the stuff going on around North Station, North Arch, which is all part of where MICA and MICA is a deep part mm-hmm. of that, and UB is a deep part mm-hmm. of that. And a lot of people worry about how we develop the city and where it's going and who it's being developed for, whether it's around the questions of race and or class, both. Mm-hmm. Well, let me go to MICA first. Nikki, and then come over to Brianna.
Well, I'm originally from Washington, D.C., so we have our own gentrification issues currently happening where they're pricing a lot of black people out of communities. For example, my family's getting ready to move because we don't have money to live in D.C. anymore.
What part of D.C. y'all live in?
Northwest, uptown, closer to Silver Spring.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So we have to move out to PG County in Maryland just so we can afford.
Come here. Baltimore.
I would love to. I mean, I love Baltimore. It's an awesome city. However, I still love D.C. But anyway, I see that happening around MICA as well. I mean, the things that they tell some of the students at the school, the previous administration, were things like, don't go this far past North Avenue because it's dangerous. And
really?
Yeah, they kind of try to keep us, I don't want to say keep us in a bubble, but we have our own issues as far as campus safety in the area. But you can clearly see that some of the houses, it just changes. There's, a clear divide. Once you pass, Utah mm-hmm. from MICA, it's, straight, all the apartments start to look the same, and it kind of starts to be getting to look more impoverished, as opposed to, you have, the nice Bolton Hill, row houses, different colors, families walking. And I've even talked to somebody in the neighborhood, and they told me that the Bolton Hill kids have a separate Halloween that they go trick-or-treating because they don't want their kids mixing with the other kids. Yep. So, I mean,
that's true.
That you have true. That that's divide. True. That's true. That's, I mean, that's what's happening.
When I first heard that story, it really blew me away about Halloween, that actually happened, that people take their kids out mm-hmm. another night, not Halloween night, to separate it from everybody else who might come trick-or-treating mm-hmm. so they can shut their doors and all the black kids come through the neighborhood trick-or-treating from across North Avenue. That is something I heard that more than once, and that was just shocking to hear that story. Brianna?
I was just going to piggyback off of what Nikki said. I'm also not from Baltimore. I'm actually from Philadelphia, which people say isn't too different, but Philadelphia is bigger. And as I was driving in the city, each time I come back to school, I see all the boarded up homes and just how, like she said, impoverished it looks. And then once you get across that bridge and once you reach MICA, Bolton Hill, it's like instant change. And I think that's something that definitely needs to happen. There are all these boarded up homes that no one's doing anything about. And then you look at all the families that don't have anywhere to live and you're just like, why? Why is it so difficult to give them? I know it's gonna be a lot of work, but isn't it worth it at the end of the day to do something about all these families?
Can we get to the phones here and you all can respond to the phone calls as they come in? Is that all right? 410, mm-hmm. and we make how we got to get you back, and we haven't said anything for 20 minutes. That's very unusual.
I know.
410-319-8888 is the number here. Let's go to Dickens. You've been holding on for a long time. Welcome. You're on the air.
Thank you. I would do first thing I would do is call an audit. first thing I would do is call an audit on the city. Then from after the audit, I would shut down North Avenue and build it back up from North Avenue school system, the board of education. I shut that down and reestablish it. And if you're not on, and if you don't have a child in the city school system, you would not be able to be a part of the board. And once your child is no longer in school, then you have to come up out of your position. So, I mean, we got to do things where so you have a vested interest within what's going on in the city. A lot of the people that's leading or don't even stay in the city, you know, that's really calling the shots, they're not in the city. So we got to get the school system together, you know, take care of our elders and these boarded up houses, get that money back that the city started putting in their pocket when the federal government took that money from them so that we can put these homeless people back in the houses. So, I mean, it's... First, we got to start cleaning up the house before we can start, you know, cleaning up around the town. We got to get the politicians out of the office that's putting all the money in their pocket.
To quote Bob Marley.
Get that together. You know, get people in positions that really have the city interest in heart. You know what I mean? So, yeah.
Well, Dickens, thanks so much for that. Let me turn to Michaela, then we'll go over to Joseph.
I would like to say that I definitely agree with his comment because a lot of the people in a position of power don't live in the city, don't have kids that go to school in the city. So how can you tell me what needs to be done with my kids' school or how my kids should live if you don't live here and you don't have to experience the things that they have to experience in these Baltimore City public schools? I went to a Baltimore City public school, and granted, I went to City, which is on the up and up, quote unquote. We still have issues that other schools have. I had a book with my teacher's name in it. He graduated in 1969. So across the board, there are issues like that in schools that should be fixed. But because we have teachers who don't live in Baltimore City, we have administrators who don't live in Baltimore City, a lot of politicians have city addresses only because they work for a certain district but live in other places. That's an issue. And because they don't have the same interest in Baltimore City, they won't do what needs to be done. And as far as the gentrification, we need to understand that this has happened before. It happens repeatedly in cities. There's a moment where they push black people to the city, then they push black people back out the city, then he pushes back into the city, and at this moment they're pushing us back out because the mayor said herself she wanted to bring in 10,000 new families. And so she's doing what she feels needs to be done. That's the 21st century schools. That's redoing the Edmondson community with the red line and the redoing of 40 and things like that to bring in the families that she thinks is going to stay in the city, invest in the city, and grow Baltimore the way that she envisions it. But that also displaces a lot of people who have lived in Baltimore all their lives, lived in these areas where they are gentrifying, and now they're going to be misplaced again, only for in another 10, 20 years for them to push them back in the same places that they lived in.
Joseph.
And I also want to say that if you really notice that it is a lot of homeless people downtown and that don't have nowhere to go, but you have a lot of vacant homes. You have a lot of blocks, like whole blocks that's vacant from each side of the street. Like, I feel like you should use them for the homeless people. If you're not, knock them down. Make racks for the kids. Make a school. You making jails, but you can't make a school for the kids that's coming up, that's under us, that the generation that's coming up. Like, you just having these empty blocks that's boarded up and everything like that. And they not being utilized at all. And another thing I want to, a point that I want to say is with the body cameras, I definitely agree with the body cameras. But in the same token, I feel like the body cameras is on a police officer, which means the camera is pointing to whoever they are associating or
looking at the moment.
But it's not actually looking at the police. So I feel I agree with it, but I feel like they would have to like go more into detail with that.
Go ahead. I was gonna put it out there. One of the things I was trying to push the mayor on when she was here last about where we go in the city, and your thoughts on this was that body cameras are great, but if there's not a civilian review board that has the authority to control the police department and make decisions about what happens, and the independent prosecutor that can investigate and indict when these things happen, then you know Eric Garner was on camera. And all we heard was, "I can't breathe."
I mean, I agree with what you're saying. I mean, Aragon obviously was on camera. Tamir Rice, you know, he was on camera too. Mm-hmm. And body cameras is one answer, not the answer. We have to understand that there injustice has been happening for a very long time. There's going to be a lot of things that we need to change in order to address it. When you talk about body cameras facing the citizen, the reason, the idea is right there is to capture the situation, to understand what's actually going on and to see if what the police officer responded to was a proper thing, right? So we don't necessarily need to catch to see what, you know, whether the police officer had his shoes ties, but we do need to know if this person was actually waving a knife or actually had a gun or whether it was just a pill bottle. I mean, that's really the idea to body cameras. I mean,
I understand. We always do challenge, but I think they are important. I'm just saying sometimes I think we have to take it like this extra push and step. Scheherazade, then Brianna.
In addition to that, I see that the body cameras can act as a way to be like a big brother, if you will, because you're a little more conscious of what you're doing if you think everybody's watching. In the Eric Garner situation, somebody else was recording. I don't know if they were aware that the person was recording, but when you know that there is a camera attached to you for all the world to see, I think you're going to act a little differently.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope that would be something that affects the way they act.
Yeah. We're going to say shares out there, Mom.
As I was listening to you, and you said what's important is the prosecutors who are going to indict, because, you know, as I was watching the Ferguson situation unfold, and I know that there was a witness 40, whose testimony was submitted, who obviously didn't try to hide their bias, and I just thought that that was strange that testimony of that nature would even be submitted for a grand jury to see.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the prosecutor in that instance could have exercised a little bit more discretion. And so you need to have someone, like you said, serving in that capacity that's going to be able to make sure that the grand jury is seeing the testimony that it actually needs to see.
Right.
Make sure that someone's there that's exercising discretion and actually doing their job right, like someone who's going to actually indict. Because I think that the prosecutor in that instance, I mean, along with if you listen to him the night that the decision came down, I almost thought that he was the defense attorney.
Mm-hmm.
It sounded like he was the defense attorney. We had a law professor in here yesterday, Doug Colbert from the other law school. But he was a great lawyer and a good friend. One of the things he described about this thing, I'll just throw this out here, is think about what mayors can do and the challenges you can make to law, is that he challenged the whole notion of a grand jury system is almost antiquated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that the idea that, and I didn't know this until I was listening to him and started reading, that a grand jury system is a 12th century European phenomenon from the Middle Age, from the medieval period.
Hmm.
That do we really need a grand jury where we don't know who's doing the indicting, we don't know who's sitting on it, how they're being chosen, who runs it? Is it even necessary to have this system any longer in American jurisprudence, which I think is a question we should ask, because, you know, the only people getting indicted are they don't use grand juries to indict me, you, or anybody at this table. If you got arrested, you just would be charged and indicted. We only use it when it comes to people in power.
Yeah.
Well, that's not completely true, but that's how it's used a great deal.
I mean, but when you look at the way that the case was handled, when you look at the evidence that the prosecutor put forward and the way that he put it forward, when you look at the statements that he made, even explaining, you know, his stance after he was, you know, when he was actually making the announcement, it looks like to me that the individual is like, you know what, I don't want this guy to have to go to trial. And I don't want my name saying that he's not going to go to trial. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to put it off on someone else. I'm going to say that, oh, well, the grand jury decided that he shouldn't get indicted. And
we have like 2 minutes left in this segment before we have to go to the city paper. So a very quick thought from Scheherazade, come over here.
And to go along with that, because the grand jury is composed of lay individuals, are they being instructed properly? Do they know that their job is not to decide guilt or innocence at that stage, but rather just to decide should this individual be charged with a crime, any crime at all? And there's a difference in the standard that you evaluate these things by. It's a big difference. Probable cause is completely different from a reasonable doubt standard. So that's something to
And our next segment is actually going to talk about the city paper, which because they come on every week at this time, to talk about the demonstrations. So maybe you guys want to hang in place to hear what they have to say about their article. You might have some comments about that, too. But give us 10 seconds, man. We have to run out.
One more solution that I think that would be helpful is, like, if you're familiar with Play 60 for the sports, like basketball, the NBA and the NFL, they actually come into the community. They put events together in the community at parks and schools, and they come out. I think the police should actually get involved more with the community because the crime rate will go actually down.
Mm-hmm. So this has been great. I really enjoyed meeting the six of you, and I hope that you all will consider coming back on the show as guests just to be just in any of our programs talking about the city and the future of society, where we're going. It'd be great to, and as we talk about gentrification, having all of your thoughts, it'd be great to have you all back. I just want to reiterate one more time who's been in the studio with me here. Scheherazade Abdelmajid and Brian Upshur are law students at the University of Baltimore who joined us here. We are joined by Michaela Brown and Joseph Kent from Morgan State University. And Brianna Arrington and Nikki Hendricks, who leads the Black Student Union at MICA, who joined us here in studio as well. Great to have the six of you here. This is great.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
When I see the six of you, I feel good about where we're going. This is good. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're going to take a brief break, and as we go to break, we're going to hear Feels Good by Tony Tone. Today is the birthday of Timothy Christian, member of that group born on this day in 1966. We'll be right back with the City Paper and Baynard Woods. Don't go away. It's so good to me.